Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I admire your luck, Mr.
Bond. James Bond.
Hello and welcome to episode 14 of AI Movie Night. I'm your host, Joe Simpson, and tonight I'm joined by two great guests to discuss all things James Bond. Firstly, I'm lucky enough to be joined by Dan Kennett, host of the excellent AI Analytics podcast. How you doing, Dan?
Hey, Joe. Good mate. Really looking forward to this. Really, really looking forward to this.
Oh, me too, mate. Thanks very much for joining me. I can't wait to hear your thoughts. I know you're a massive fan. I'm also lucky enough to be joined by the excellent LFC statistician and AI contributor, Andrew Beasley. How you doing, mate?
Yeah, good, thanks, Joe. Thanks for inviting me on. Looking forward to this a lot. I always seem to do podcasts with Dan, but obviously it's a different kind of thing this week. But
yeah, we come as a pair.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, I think that's why it's good as well, because obviously, you know, we all know he's off Twitter and off podcasts, but it'd be nice to see that other side. I know Gags was joking that he'll have stats about Bond. You probably do know and use too. You probably could rustle up a few if you wanted, but I know you absolutely love the films and have got a hell of a lot of knowledge. So thanks very much for joining me. Obviously, as you know better than me, there's a hell of a lot to cover with Bond, so I'm going to get straight into it. I want to start with my usual question firstly to Dan, and it's, can you remember when and where you first saw a James Bond film for the first time and what you thought of it?
So I can't remember exactly when it was, but it would have been either a bank holiday or Christmas holiday on BBC One or ITV when I in the early 80s, because it doesn't happen anymore, but back then, it used to be, you know, only four TV channels, no on demand, and it was pretty much put a film on, at, you know, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon or 6 o'clock in the, you know, in the evening, and literally the whole country would sit down to watch it, a Bond film and stuff like that, and it would have been Roger Moore, probably one with Jaws, so just like Spy Who Loved Me or Moonraker, and very much that era. I mean, and it was really weird. They didn't even show that many Connery ones at that age. It was, I'm pretty sure it was all Roger Moore in that early 80s when I first started, you know, getting that recall. But I definitely remember Jaws, you know, biting through the cable, the cable car, things like that on telly, and when he was fighting him in the pyramids and all that kind of stuff. So, it was definitely something like that for me.
That is very similar to myself, to be honest with you. I think, as you say, in those days, you know, it was harder to get hold of things and there was less variety of media to entertain you. So, as you say, I mean, you had four channels and, you know,
but there was virtually no VHS at that point,
yeah,
either.
Yeah.
I think Betamax VHS didn't come around until like about 82, 83, did it?
True. And I mean, the other thing about it is, as you say, it was almost like an event as well, you know, the Bond films, you know, the whole family at times would sit round and watch it, because it's got something for everyone, I suppose. And mine was also the Roger Moore era, and I think it's hard to say, like you said, I mean, I can't be certain this is the first one I watched or saw any of, but the memory that sticks in my head is the ski jump and parachute off
Spy Love Me
with the Union Jack flag.
And that's iconic, though. Yeah.
And that's the one that sticks in my head. I'm not 100% it was the first memory, but it's definitely the one that stuck in my head the most. So we've got similar experiences there. What about yourself, Andrew?
Mine was sort of similar, but sort of different. I, as a kid, I think anybody who's probably under the age of about 60 has probably always had Bond there in the background growing up in this country. So I'd see little bits and bobs of them on TV, but I wouldn't be able to say I'd seen a specific one all the way through. And then when I was about, I think it was about 16 or 17, they brought out a box set of VHS videos of all of the films from Dr. No, the first one, up to GoldenEye had been the most recent one. So it's about 15, 16 videos. So essentially, the first one I can say I definitely watched all the way through was Dr. No, because I bought this box set and then I just went through the films in order. But of course, then when you're watching them, consciously watching them, you're like, oh, I remember Thunderball with all the underwater stuff. And I remember Moonraker when they go to space. But I couldn't say for definite that I'd seen one, you know, all the way through until that point. So, strangely, I kind of watched them all in order. It's probably a good way to do it, actually, because I think a lot of the early ones are the better ones, but I'm sure we'll come on to all of that. But that's how I kind of discovered it anyway.
I think you've had a very, that's a great privilege you've had there, that you've been able to watch them in order, as you say, without being there at the time they first came out. So I'll be interested to hear your perspective based on that and whether it's any different from me and Dan, because I don't know what Dan's thoughts will be, and I know we'll cover it more later, but I can't help but feel my sort of perspective on Bond is heavily skewed by the fact that my Bond was Roger Moore, because as I grew up, he was the Bond I knew at first. So it'd be interesting to see if there's any different perspective coming from yourself to me and Dan maybe, but obviously we'll touch on that later. Obviously, we touched on it a little bit there. The Bond films, they've been going for over 50 years now and are still, you know, phenomenally successful. Why do you think they've been so enduringly popular, Andrew?
I think people do love a sort of formula, and obviously they sort of toy with it a bit, but they do tend to follow, you know, a fairly sort of rigid formula of opening sequence, theme song with, you know, titles, he gets a mission, he goes off, etc., etc. You know, they are kind of broadly similar each time, and people like that because they kind of know what they're going to get. I think as well they have kind of changed with the times as well. You know, you couldn't really do a sort of a really 60s style one anymore, because Austin Powers basically came along and ruined that, or the chances of doing that again. So they have kind of moved with the times, and it's kind of changed. And obviously now it's, you know, it's not quite Batman or whatever, but it's a little bit darker in the Daniel Craig era than certainly they used to. I mean, certainly the Roger Moore era that you were just sort of referring to. So I think it's kind of a combination of those things. And I think they were lucky that sort of when they started in the 60s, they just showed a world that I think people of that era, I'm guessing as a younger person, but people of that era probably hadn't seen. You know, they hadn't been to all these exotic places around the world that he was going to, and he was sort of, you know, this British guy just sort of socking it to the rest of the world. So I would think that's, you know, how it sort of started off being popular, and it's just kind of grown and grown from there. What do you reckon, Dan?
I think I do agree with all of that. I think there's a few factors here. I think the main one, obviously, is the strength. First of all, is the strength of the novels by Ian Fleming, because when you're basing it on such a great series of novels, that it's pretty difficult to make a bad job of that, because the underlying plot is there, and the characters. Now, the only thing concerning me going forward is that Skyfall was actually the last one of those, the last Fleming book that they hadn't done. And I wasn't particularly impressed with Spectre and the writing for Spectre. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, maybe a slight wrinkle for concern going forward for the franchise. But I think another thing is that, and Andrew touched on this at the time, is that the context of early Bond was the Cold War. There were always Spygate stories. There was people like you know, Anthony Burgess, you know, all the traitors stories in the UK, and all the Cold War and MI5 and CIA and the KGB. And I think people could really relate to that, and it really fed into that at the time. And that's one of the things that I think gave it lift off. But I think most of all, on top building on top of those two things, I think it's just the character himself, obviously, which does come from Ian Fleming, is that it's just the pure indulgence, the hedonism, and overall, it's the masculinity of the character. You know, he's got the best cars, mm-hmm. best clothes, the best food, the best wine, yeah. the best women, the best locations.
Which it's fulfillment, just, isn't it?
It is. It's absolutely, it's pure indulgence, you know, and every man wants to be him in that respect, because it's the best of the best. And as well as that, he's the embodiment of, you know, real masculinity. Well, Connery was especially, you know. And yeah, I think that it was a winning formula. And right from Dr. No, it just skyrocketed.
I think you've both summed it up really well. And those two points you've both made about, you know, you've got this sort of formula, as Andrew says, that gives you all these things that particularly in that era are so, you know, outlandish and far away, and as he said, exotic locations, amazing gadgets and cars and like the fine dining and, you know, sharp suits, and, you know, it's got a bit of everything. And then
it was all the sins as well, like gambling, yeah. you know, killing, sex, you know, yeah. it's all these things that the exciting things, you know.
and as you say, and then you mix that up with you know, this you know, screen god in Sean Connery, who like portrayed from what I've read, obviously I don't know as much about the books as you guys, but portrayed so much of the Bond characteristics, but brought his own things to it as well, that sort of added to it and made it even more, you know, more of a charismatic character. Because I think, if I understand correctly, I think Fleming's original idea was to have him to be a bit more of a, you know, less charismatic character. And I think Connery brought that charisma to it, that sort of took it in a slightly different direction and added to it. And I love that idea of, like, him bringing his own stuff. And obviously, as you say, yeah. he brings a toughness as well, just from his normal...
Allegedly, most of Connery's... gags, you know, he used to do was were ad libs from him.
Oh,
know?
I see. Didn't he?
And you know the one we I can't think it's in Goldfinger. Where he puts the guy in the bath and throws in the fan, and shocking. What was he putting on his jacket as well? I bet most of those kind of things were ad libs from Connery himself. So
that's amazing, because yeah. they add so much to it for me, and sort of they give you two aspects of that bond. I suppose it's like, you're seeing that cold-blooded nature, and it sort of adds to it that he can just do a one-liner like that, but in a way that's still...
cool.
Yeah, totally. And still retains his power, whereas I think when, say, Roger Moore does it's more, although I do like that, it then becomes more of a comedy, whereas Connery, it still retains its danger, and I just think that's really... A really nice way to lead on to my next question, I suppose, which is to you first, Dan. It's what's your favourite Bond film and why?
For a long, long time, it was From Russia with Love. Mm-hmm. And it's only just been recently overtaken by Casino Royale, I think, is my favourite. But they're very much on a par for those two for me. But I'll just talk about the oldest one first, because mm-hmm. some people might not be familiar with that one. Mainly because it's a classic Cold War-style thriller, spy thriller. Mm-hmm. There's very little in the way of gadgets, you know, but you've got KGB, a lot of it set in Turkey. You've got local partisans, you've got people blowing up other factions, you've got the KGB everywhere. There's a fantastic scene where they do a reconnaissance on the underground canals underneath the Russian embassy, and then the next day they go in and steal the decoding machine from the embassy itself, and then the whole thing is they've got to get the decoding machine out of Turkey, and then they travel on the Orient Express all the way through sort of the Soviet bloc behind the Iron Curtain, and they're trying to get to Italy, obviously, where it's a safe haven. This with this fantastically important decoding machine. So it's absolutely, you know, completely immersed that storyline in the Cold War, and obviously the name of the title was From Russia with Love as well. And obviously then you've got one of the best baddies ever in Robert Shaw, who plays kind of dark Bond. Killer Bond on from Spectre, and the whole sequence with them, he kills, becomes their contact on the way out, and he is a fantastic character, one of the all-time best Robert Shaw there, because he's absolutely enormous. He's like 6'5", I think, and he's lean and mean, and he's like Ivan Drago or something, you know, in Rocky.
Do you know what it reminds me of, Dan, funnily enough, and I don't often mention football in these, but I've got to say, that bit where they're in the park and she walks around them reminds me of the Ron Yates Colossus thing. Inspecting this huge physical specimen, and that's what it always reminds me of. But you just to agree with your point, yeah.
It was almost like an early version of Bourne, where they train this kind of super soldier, you know, to go out and do killing orders on behalf of Spectre, you know, or was it Smursk? I don't know which one.
And you believe as well, don't you? You believe he. Considering how good Connery is and how, as you say, he's brilliant at everything, you believe this guy genuinely has a chance, don't you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And we're going to come on to some of this. I'll talk about other bits from that film as we go on later on, but it is absolutely brilliant. I would recommend it to anybody who hasn't seen it.
Great shows. What about yourself, Andrew?
Well, funnily enough, I was... that's probably my favourite, although it often fluctuates. But obviously, I won't talk about that again. I'll talk a little bit about Goldfinger, because that was my favourite for a long time and possibly still is. I think it's the most entertaining one, certainly. And I think if you like Bond films generally, most of the things, the formula that we were sort of talking about before, most of them basically originated in Goldfinger. Not that they, you know... touches of it in the first two films, but that one it was sort of really established of, you know, opening sequence, the incredible theme song as well. I went to watch a screening of it in the cinema a few years ago now, but you see the opening, I mean, I knew what was going to happen, but you see the opening scene and it, you know, positively shocking, it is that thing in the bath, and then it's like the theme song comes on and it is so loud and you're like, wow. And it's just incredible, really. And then, yeah, it's got the great, obviously, the Aston Martin with the gadgets, entertaining, sort of slightly comedy villain with real, like, tough, iconic henchman in Odd Job with his bowler hat. Has he got a razor on the rim or some metal on the rim or something like that? Obviously, the girl painted in gold. I mean, I suppose in some way now it kind of seems like cliche, but I think... probably pound for pound it's the most entertaining of the Bond films, and so I sort of fluctuate between that and From Russia with Love as my favourite, but I would strongly recommend either of those to anyone who hasn't seen them.
Two great choices by you both there, and I think what's great about it, and I think we'll obviously talk about this in more depth later about those two choices, is they were back-to-back films and they're so different. Obviously they do have some of the same formula as we've said, but you know, as Dan said, From Russia with Love is a lot more of a thriller, whereas this is more of your staple James Bond sort of, you know, thrill ride, I suppose, is a way I'd describe it. And back to back, and they're so different, and they're both brilliant in some very different ways, but also in some similar ways.
And I think Goldfinger was definitely the one that took it into the stratosphere, the popularity. And I always remember this interview with McCartney, Paul McCartney, and he said that everybody had to have, who was anybody, had to have the DB9. And McCartney would just go around Liverpool in his DB9, picking up girls, saying, "Hey, do you want to come for a ride in my DB9?
Brilliant. Yeah.
It's like everybody had to have one because, you know, obviously they could afford them, being in the Beatles.
Oh, fantastic. And it's ironic as well, because in that film, they actually make a joke at the Beatles' expense, don't they? They say something like, Bond says something like, "The only way to enjoy the Beatles is with earmuffs," or something, I think is one of the lines he says. It's funny that, you know, and obviously later, as we know that we'll touch on later, McCartney does his own Bond song, which obviously is fantastic, but that's a different story. But, oh no, you're right. I think that's where it really went big. And I mean, I don't know whether other people have this, but like, I when I was younger, and I've still got it to some extent with certain things. Sometimes you have mental blocks. And I think because I grew up with that more era, and obviously it was more, things were a lot more colourful just in general, I had this idea that the Connery Bonds were drab and things like that, obviously how wrong I was. And Goldfinger was the one that made me realise, oh my word, you know, I stumbled, it was on one time and I sort of left it on. And it's so colourful and so fun. And that was what made me watch the others and see how great they really were. Obviously, I'd heard about them and I knew they were good anyway, but they just didn't appeal to me. And that was my gateway, I suppose, to the Connery Bonds. And I think with us mentioning the formula, I don't know whether you'd agree, the beauty of Goldfinger is, as well as maybe setting that template, you know, in terms of bringing in most of those things, near enough everything in it in terms of those different aspects. If we were having, like, I know we'll be touching on some of them later, they're all vying for the winner in each thing, you know, theme song, you know, car, you know, henchman, bad guy. They're all in terms of throughout the Bond films.
Gadget with the laser as well.
Yeah.
The torture scene.
Yeah, you're right. It's near enough everything in it. You know, Bond moments like the you know, getting out of the wetsuit and that. It's full of these iconic moments, and you just echo you both. Two great shouts then. I'm now going to look at, obviously, we've sort of mentioned this slightly, but we haven't really examined it in terms of your perspectives. I'm going to look at who is your favourite Bond. So not necessarily the best, although you can tell us that as well. That'd be interesting to hear. But who's your favourite Bond? And I'll start with you on this one, please, Andrew.
Well, I might have given it away already, I guess. But for me, it's definitely Connery. You know, you talking about sort of like the Roger Moore era, I've always preferred the slightly more sort of realistic end of it, so probably Connery, Daniel Craig, Timothy Dalton to a lesser extent. I just think, as we've sort of touched on, I think Connery, he's just sort of believable as a spy, basically, as this sort of tough guy going around killing people and doing stuff like that with the occasional quip and stuff, but and very charming. Whereas for me, Roger Moore, I just never sort of really believed that he'd be, you know, beating these guys up or whatever, that he'd either want to or that he could do or whatever. So, yeah, I think, again, as I mentioned, whether it's from watching the films kind of in order. So it was essentially the first Bond that I saw properly, sort of films all the way through from start to finish. But no, it's definitely Connery for me.
And I'm going to have to be boring, I'm afraid, and pile on with Connery. what I want him to be suave. I want him to be handsome, but I also want him to be physically credible.
Yeah.
Right. And he has to be able to physically kick the shit out of bad guys. Right. Mm-hmm. And Connery could do that. He was a big lad, Connery. And the only one who can really do it apart from him is Daniel Craig, who's pretty credible in his physical stuff. Now, I think the likes of Moore and Brosnan, they had to substitute. Moore in his earliest films wasn't so bad, but they had to substitute the physicality with comedy because they couldn't do the physical side in a convincing enough way. And now Connery and Brosnan and Roger Moore both made good films, don't get me wrong, but overall I prefer Connery and Craig. And the biggest problem with the other two, they substituted the comedy in, but they also were too old. And they went on too long. I mean, Pierce Brosnan got the role in 1995, but he was originally going to get it in 1986 before Timothy Dalton. But he was tied into like an American TV network contract and he couldn't break it. Yeah. I think it was Remington Steele or something like that. But if he'd got the role in the mid-80s, I think it would have been a lot better for him. But, I mean, as it was, his first couple of films were pretty good. I enjoyed those with GoldenEye and Tomorrow Never Dies. But the last couple were pretty ropey, to be honest. But, yeah, physicality, good. Too much comedy, not for me. A little bit is a good thing, like we said. But, yeah too much is it, yeah.
Couldn't agree more. I think, as you can probably tell, Moore's my favourite for the reasons I've mentioned, growing up with him and things like that. But I think his films also, because of that more comedic, you know, tone to it and things like that, more lighthearted, I think because of that, they date more as well, whereas the Connery ones are more timeless to me anyway. Even though Moore tends to be my favourite, I'm more likely these days to watch a Connery than a Moore, and I think that's probably a large part of it. And I agree with you both. I think it is. I think Daniel Craig said he wanted to look like he could believably break someone's neck. And I think Connery had that anyway, and I think he was a tough guy in real life, and I think that definitely played a part as well. And I think you do have to believe that. And I think, although Moore did at times bring this to the role, he admitted himself he didn't have that sort of anywhere in his character, that sort of cold-blooded nature, so it was harder for him to do that. So it was more natural to bring, you know, the comedy side of things. So no, if you can't really look past Connery. Sort of a bit like what I said with the Goldfinger before. I suppose if you look at Connery, he's got the lot, hasn't he? And he hasn't just got them; he's got them to an extremely high standard.
Yeah, I think in terms of sophistication and suaveness, I think the best one was definitely Pierce Brosnan.
Yeah,
and I think he had the best delivery of James Bond of any of them he could do. And you know, my missus definitely agrees he's the most handsome of all of the Bonds as well. In that respect, so you think he's doing something right. But he was really, really good in large parts of the role, just not the fighting.
Yeah, I'd agree. But the other thing I like about Bond, and I'd imagine you would agree as well, is the beauty of these different type of actors doing it. It forces the filmmakers to go in different directions, so it always keeps it fresh to some degree. They all bring something different to the party. I know, like, Timothy Dalton's films have been criticised, but I really enjoy them, and it's a different type of Bond, and you know, there's something to that it does force them to take it in little directions and maybe freshen it up. I know it doesn't always work, but no, I think they all bring something to the party, no doubt.
And in defence of Roger Moore, there is something. He is a bit of a clothes horse. He does look good in a suit, and you know, any man who can carry off a safari suit as well as he can. There's a lot to be said for that.
Yeah, I think it's one of them though as well. I imagine Connery would just say no. There's no way I'm wearing that, and that'll be the end of it. Whereas I think Moore was probably a much more compliant with requests like that. I'm sure, but yeah, the safari.
The raised eyebrow as well. I think.
Yeah, but I feel a bit bad on him. I do still love him as well, but there are bits. And as you say, I think he was 2 years older than Connery when he got it, you know, than Connery actually was. And I think, although that it meant for the first few films, he was sort of like a peak age. As you say, he was near enough a pensioner by the last one, wasn't he, if I recall correctly?
Yeah, well, the last Octopussy and Beauty Were Killed, they were just too far.
Totally agree. We're now going to look at, obviously we've mentioned the formula, and we're going to look at some of the different parts of that formula. We're now going to look at the great Bond villains and henchmen. Do you have a particular favourite, Dan?
Well, I've got a few, but I'll do one and then I'll let Bees have one of his. But I just want to say Live and Let Die, okay? Yeah. Because I think it's got the best collection of villains of any film. Because it wasn't just one of them. There was Kananga, Mr. Big, and then they had Teehee with his metal hand, cutting hand. You had Baron Samedi, the voodoo guy, priest. that film there was absolutely fantastic.
Yeah,
that was at that was when they tried to make it first time. I think he went to New York, and it was the peak of the blaxploitation cinema scene and stuff like that. And it was just a fantastic. What's a collective noun for a group of villains?
A gaggle of villains.
But that was one of my favourites.
I love that film. That's possibly my favourite, to be honest with you. And that's one of the key reasons that the different types of bad guy as well. And like, you know, I think probably Teehee's very memorable to me because he's sort of, obviously he's huge and very, very strong, and he's got that arm, but he's also, he's got like a sense of humour, and he like takes joy in the badness he's doing, and there's something about that's really watchable for me. So no, I love those shouts. What about yourself, Andrew?
I think mine's probably Scaramanga from The Man with the Golden Gun.
Oh, brilliant.
Oh, yeah.
Just kind of like an anti-Bond, if you like, sort of very similar kind of person to Bond, but obviously a bad guy. And obviously Christopher Lee's pretty much amazing in most things, to be honest. So, I think he's mine. I echo what you said about Live and Let Die, another one of my favourites of the films, and a great collection of bad guys. Of the more recent ones, I did quite enjoy Javier Bardem as Silver in Skyfall, in that it's sort of a bit crazy and camp, but sort of just the right side of the line. Doesn't really go too far. So of the more recent ones, I reckon he's probably the best. But probably Scaramanga, best one overall, I would think.
I think we're agreeing here. Christopher Lee and Javier Bardem were also my ones as well. So
there we go.
Yeah, Javier Bardem does that sort of borderline insanity thing really well, better than pretty much any other ones I think in the whole series.
Yeah, definitely.
He's got that brooding menace, but he's really erratic. He's a genius, but he's erratic. He's, you know, and yeah, so fantastic character. A couple of minor ones I wanted to ask. One of my absolute favourites is in Tomorrow Never Dies. He's a really minor character called Dr. Kaufman.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
And he's said to kill him. And I don't know, maybe the fact that he's so matter-of-fact German and he's an assassin and he's a forensic doctor or whatever. I don't know, but he is just an awesome minor bad guy.
Oh yeah,
And one I have to mention is Famke Janssen as Xenia Onatopp in GoldenEye. So that was a personal favourite of mine. I can't figure out why, but
no, she is fantastic, and I think she really helps Brosnan as well, because their clashes are just really good, aren't they? She was very, as well as being gorgeous. Obviously, she was very very believably tough. And she had that. She another one of those. Obviously, they all have this to some extent, but she really did take pleasure in inflicting pain. I think if I recall correctly, there's a bit where she's being pulled by the sort of rope, and she's firing away with the machine gun, and she's in ecstasy, isn't she?
That is going to some pretty weird shit, because she's sort of kind of semi-orgasmic while she's machine gunning a room full of defenseless people. It's pretty weird shit.
It is. I think that's a bit like Silver, though, isn't it? I think when they have that extra element of, you know, really weirdly mad, it gives it an extra fear factor, because I think Bond, say, obviously, there's a lot of megalomaniacs and things like that, but say a Goldfinger or someone like that, Bond can more reason with them, with logic and things, whereas the likes of Silver, it's not possible, do you know what I mean? They're more unhinged, or at least that's my impression. But no, some great shouts there. I think another one I'd like to shout out to is Sean Bean, Alex Trevelyan in GoldenEye. I think he's a really good bad guy. And I think there's a theme with the ones I like anyway, or some of the ones, is like they're all to some extent mirror images. So Red Grant is a mirror image of sort of the physical nature of Bond. Scaramanga's a mirror image of the sort of marksmanship. And then obviously with Alex Trevelyan, he's the mirror image of the whole. He's also been a spy and a similarly skilled guy, but with this grudge and ex-friends, and just, you know, I just think that was a really good dynamic. So I suppose.
Well, yeah, it's the same. Alex Trevelyan and Javier Bardem and Silver, they were both double O's, ex-double O's, weren't they?
So. Yeah. So that gives them that extra, you know, skill level, I suppose, that they know a lot of the same tricks and have a lot of the same training, but there's just so many. We could go on forever, really, with you guys. There's just so many, but I love those shouts. We're now going to look at another thing it's very famous for, is the Bond girls. And do you have a particular favourite, Andrew?
There are a lot to choose from. There's normally three or four in every film, so it's probably quite difficult to pick a favourite. I've always had a soft spot for Diana Rigg in On Her Majesty's Secret Service. I think she's really good. And it's kind of, I think, because they were going with George Lazenby, who was basically just a tough-looking model, I think they needed like a really strong sort of good actress in the main sort of Bond girl role in that one. And she's really good. I'm trying to think of another favourite. I like as well a lady called Maud Adams, who plays Octopussy, and she's also in The Man with the Golden Gun, just because I think she was good in the later Bond films because she actually looks roughly Roger Moore's age, whereas a lot of his Bond girls in his last few films look like they were basically his granddaughter, which is no good. Yeah. So, I mean, especially that, well, obviously there's that one he turns down in For Your Eyes Only, but the main Bond girl in View to a Kill, I think Roger Moore was older than her mum or something when they were filming it. And it's like, as you've said, he sort of stayed on a film or two too long probably, but, no, Maud Adams is really good and sort of a match for the, slightly more doddery Roger Moore. I think they're definitely a couple of my favourites. I'm trying to think. Dan,
you have a think, but there's honestly, there's so many, Joe, there's so many hot women in James Bond. Right, I want to give a shout out for some of the more recent ones, right? Mm-hmm. The World Is Not Enough, not a particularly great film, but probably the best looking double act, Denise Richards and Sophie Marceau in The World Is Not Enough, is just amazing. Mm-hmm. Both those do like double trouble. And I have to say as well that Dying of the Day, which is even worse film, Halle Berry in that film is just unbelievable. She even comes out the sea better than Ursula Andress. I mean, and that's saying
something.
Oh, no,
I'm going to fight you on that one, Kenneth, I'm afraid.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, Ursula Andress is a good shout. And as soon as you said recent films, Vespa Lynch just popped into my head straight away. I don't know why I didn't think of that before. Eva Green is amazing.
Yeah, no.
She's probably the best of the recent bunch for me, I think.
Some great shouts there. The one
just in terms of pure gorgeousness, mm-hmm. though, not necessarily great characters. I mean, probably the best looking of all is Britt Eklund, because it's Britt Eklund, you know, Miss World. But her, in The Man with the Golden Compass, she's an absolutely awful character, awful bimbo character. But she's so, you know, she's just Britt Eklund, isn't it? You know, Mrs. Ringo Starr Spy Who Loved Me, Barbara Bach,
and
Mariam Darbo in The Living Daylights as well.
Oh, no, you're right, there's so many. I think the one I fell in love with when I was a youngster was Jane Seymour as Solitaire in Live and Let Die. She was just breathtaking. And but, again, not much to her character, doesn't really do much. But you mentioned it then, Dan, Anya Amasova in The Spy Who Loves Me, as you say, Mrs. Ringo Starr. She was just fantastic. She was every inch a match for Bond, and they were one up in each other right the way through it. And she was, you know, she was given as good as she got, often getting the better of him. And I loved that sort of chemistry and that dynamic between them throughout. And obviously knowing full well that eventually it would come to a head with the fact that Bond killed their former lover. But yeah, I think she's probably my favourite because she had a lot, obviously, like all Bond girls, she was amazingly beautiful, but she was an equally good spy as Bond was, and that was great to see.
Yeah, Triple X, Agent Triple X.
Oh, that's it, yeah, Agent Triple X, oh, brilliant. No, really good. I'm now going to look at some of the other things that Bond's famous for, and some of these are my absolute favourites. The gadgets. Do you have a particular favourite gadget at all, Dan?
Yes, I don't know if I can actually narrow it down to one. I think in terms of the earliest and the most, as I've already touched on, is the DB5 in Goldfinger. Ejector seat, machine guns, bulletproof shields, or slicks, or like oil leaks as well.
It's just gorgeous as well. As
I know, it's an Aston Martin, isn't it? Aston Martin is the James Bond car. I mean, we tried BMW, we tried Lotus. But speaking of Lotus, the underwater Lotus well. Spy Who Loved Me. When they drive off the pier, and they're being chased, and you think, you know, what's going on here? And then when it first converts into the underwater car, that was just, whoa.
I had that story as a kid.
Oh, no way. Oh, like 1977, the underwater car. And it was Lotus, was pretty gorgeous as well, to be fair.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they're a couple to start with anyway. Andrew?
Fantastic.
Yeah, they're good shouts. I suppose our car's gadgets, that's probably a different debate. But I think for me, the best one, one of the films we've touched on already, From Russia With Love, he has this kind of briefcase that's got like a knife in it. It's got like a gas canister thing. It's got like some gold sovereigns in. In some ways, that sounds like quite a tame gadget. But for me, I've not always been a massive fan of the gadgets where, you know, at the start of the film, they say, right, here you are, Bond. Here's something completely random, which we don't know you'll need. And then, as luck would have it, by the end of the film, he probably needs it in some situation. Well,
he actually says in that, doesn't he? He says something like, I don't think I'll be needing that briefcase on this mission or something, I think, if I recall correctly. As the audience, you're obviously thinking, I've got a suspicion you will need it.
Yeah, exactly. And it also, for me, kind of seems like something that, you know, a spy in those days probably would realistically be given. You know, it's not that outlandish, but it's sort of potentially quite useful as it proves later in the film. Wanted to give a quick shout out as well for in Live and Let Die, Baron Samedi's got like a flute that turns into a radio. And you don't hear much about gadgets for the villains, but that's always impressed me. But I think in the later films, the gadgets were just getting silly. I mean, obviously, probably can't talk Bond without talking about the invisible car in Die Another Day as probably the ultimate low point. But then I think it's either Die Another Day or The World Is Not Enough. I can't remember exactly which one, but he's got like a sort of inflatable puffer jacket that turns into a ball or something that protects him from an avalanche. And it's like, you know, we had no idea you were going to snow, but we'll give you this puffer jacket anyway. And it sort of saves the day. So I'm not always a fan of the gadgets, but there has been a few classic ones down the years, certainly.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Sometimes when it goes to excess, and I think that helped to kill off that era of Bond, that invisible car. I think when it goes to excess, it does take something away from the film. And obviously the Craig era has had a lot less of that type of thing, and rightly so if you're talking invisible cars and things like that. I think my favourite, obviously, a lot of my things have come from Live and Let Die, but it can't be helped. I do love it. Is that magnetic watch. Now, it's funny. Obviously, it's not necessarily even that useful necessarily, but as a kid, there was just something really cool about it. And I think it was really great as well, the way they used it to, at one stage, wrong foot you in terms of, now he'll just use his magnetic watch to get the boat. And obviously, the boat's tired and he can't get it, but obviously it does come in useful later. But that was something I always wanted. And
I think it's sort of that gadget probably sets the tone for the Roger Moore films, because it's really early on and he uses it to undo a woman's dress or something. And he's like, sheer magnetism, darling, and all this. And it's, that's basically the Roger Moore films condensed into one gadget and sort of scene in his very first one, I think, probably.
Also, I think he's 45 and he's having to hide the woman in the wardrobe from his boss. It was just quite funny, you know what I mean? I think she was from another consulate or something, so there was probably more to it than that. But yeah, no, I think you're right.
I've got a couple of others I want to mention, and they're both from the Connery era. The first one is the jetpack in Thunderball.
Oh, yeah.
Now, it's just the kind of thing, because I don't think anybody had seen a jetpack before. I think it was like 1967, and it's a bit of a contrived scene. It's just the whole thing is just contrived to get him to use the jetpack so he can then escape. But it's just the fact that he uses a jetpack on the screen and no one else has even seen before. And a man can fly under his own control. I can't only imagine watching that in the 60s for the first time and seeing a man with a jetpack.
Oh, yeah. And as you say, I think we touched on it earlier, no one will have seen it, as you say, and just the excitement seeing something like that will bring into your life, because it's still exciting now, you know, to me, having something like that. So in the 60s, fantastic.
And the other one, also Connery, is Little Nelly You Only Live Twice.
The helicopter, yeah.
Yeah, the little gyrocopter, little one-man gyrocopter. And he just brings it in a suitcase, I think. Q comes over and brings it in a suitcase. And he says, "What is this, Bond son?" Bond says, "Oh, she's a wonderful little girl." And he just puts it together in fast motion. And it's just a little one-man thing when he goes on a reconnaissance mission. It's just that, again, in the 60s, a one-man helicopter. What's the chances of that?
And again, you'd still love it now, wouldn't you? You would love to go in Little Nelly.
It's just that he's bigger, it's better, it's never been done before. He's the first one to do it. He's pushing the boundaries. He's, you know, leading-edge technology and gadgets. It's just,
And he's always good at it as well. He sometimes has the odd little initial problem, but he always ends up brilliant with them, because it's just the type of guy he is, you know what I mean? Now, some great shouts again there. I think that's probably a good point to have a short break. So if you just join us in a couple of moments, we'll be back with some more Bond.
You're listening to
The Anfield Index.
The Anfield Index.
That's a great podcast channel.
Maybach, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Maybach, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Okay, I'm now going to look at some of the great opening scenes and or great stunts that Bond's famous for. Do you have any particular favourites, Andrew?
I think you'd have to go a long way to look past the parkour stuff in at the start of Casino Royale is really good. We're sort of chasing a guy over a building site and up a crane and things like that. I think the bungee jump in GoldenEye.
Definitely.
Particularly as it was the first Bond for 6 years at that point and sort of coming back with a new Bond actor. And obviously you knew who it was, obviously, but like you hadn't really seen him properly. And then he's sort of, running along this dam and does this incredible jump off it. So I think...
And then they break into a Russian base.
Yes.
Kick ass. Inside a Russian... deep inside Russia somewhere, you know.
it's like a sort of classic Bond opening to sort of restart the series, but also with that incredible sort of... I don't know if it is a bungee jump, because he doesn't go back up, but you know what I mean? It's sort of like a bungee jump anyway. Yeah. So, I mean, that's definitely one of them. Obviously, the Goldfinger one we sort of briefly mentioned earlier, where it starts off and you just sort of see this duck floating on the water, but then really it's just a sort of head thing that he's wearing, and he's in a wetsuit, and then he... undoes the wetsuit to reveal a perfect, like, white tuxedo and stuff. So, I mean, again, it's more sort of iconic moments of the Bond series, albeit not much happens in that apart from he blows something up and kills a guy in the bath. But, again, it's iconic.
Just to be clear, he comes out of the sea. He destroys an industrial complex with bombs and dynamite and timers.
Andrew's got very high standards.
Got high standards, exactly.
He takes off his wetsuit to reveal an amazing tuxedo and goes straight into a casino.
All right, I suppose that is quite good. I'll give you that. That is quite good. Only other one that springs to mind is Octopussy, when he basically flies a small plane through a barn, which doesn't sound that exciting, but when you see the film, it is. And particularly, that's not an especially good film, but it's quite a good opening sequence.
I think the GoldenEye one is really, really good because, I mean, as somebody said to me when it became apparent we were doing this, that it was a fantastic game, I think, on the Super Nintendo. I think it was.
Amazing.
It was a really good first-person shooter game. And that sequence where you go into the Russian base and then he manages to blow it up from the inside and then he gets the plane, doesn't need to get out of there at the same time, and the plane looks like it's going to crash and all that. That's a really good scene. A couple of ones I've already mentioned is from Rush With Love, because the opening sequence there is the Red Grant training scene and him killing James Bond, or a person who looks like Connery.
Yeah.
In this training complex and then he kills, we kill who you think is Bond, all the lights go on and they lift up the mask and there's Rosa Klebb and others there. So that's a really good one, because that was really clever. And the other one I really want to mention is Live and Let Die, where the three British agents all get killed at the start of the film, and obviously the ones with Baron Samedi and in the Caribbean with the snake. But the one I always remember from being a kid was the going to New Orleans.
Oh, brilliant.
And he gets stabbed at the bus stop, and there's a funeral thing come down the road. And then the guy just dies. They pick him up inside the coffin, and then it just becomes a street carnival after that. I just like it's just, and then the woman's crying. The guy, the mourner's playing the blues music, and then that is a really good opening sequence as well.
And it's got a great line as well. I think he asks, doesn't he, whose funeral is it? And he just got told yours, and then, as you say, stabbed, and then the next minute, it's party time. So, no, that's one of my favourites as well. But he's both mentioned it, the GoldenEye one, particularly setting up a new Bond who maybe some people were sceptical about. You know, obviously everybody knew he looked great, but they were sceptical about how he could handle action and stuff, and obviously another stuntman involved and stuff. But I just think that was an absolute brilliant opening sequence with, you know, it's so good in so many ways, you know, from the bungee jump to the plane, every bit of it's just the perfection.
It is a good film, GoldenEye. It's definitely in the top 10 for me.
I agree. It's a pity, as we've mentioned, that some of the later Brosnan ones didn't give him the same quality to work with, but that was definitely, you know, he started with a bang there. Now going to look at a favourite Bond theme songs. Do you have any particular favourites, Dan?
Being a fan of rock music, generally, it's got to be Chris Cornell doing You Know My Name for Casino Royale, because, you know, he's Chris Cornell from Soundgarden, and he's a brilliant vocalist, great rock vocalist anyway, and it's an absolute belting rock track for the Daniel Craig era. I absolutely love that one.
And the imagery as well at the same time is great, isn't it?
Yeah, and the other one I really want to call out, and because it's one of the first ones I bought on cassette when I was younger, was Duran Duran, A View to a Kill. Brilliant. That was a really good one. It was the only good thing about that film, to be honest. was the theme song, the Duran Duran. That was really good.
I might be getting mistaken here. Am I right in thinking one of the baddies at one point is listening to a Walkman with it on, or is that my memory playing tricks? there were a few mad bits in that one, it could be just my memory playing tricks. What about you, Andrew?
For me, I don't think you can look past Nobody Does It Better from The Spy Who Loved Me by Carly Simon, I think.
Yeah.
It's just... Yeah. I don't honestly know if it was written specifically for that, but I mean, she's, you know, the song was basically talking about Bond. It sums it up perfectly. It's a great tune. And to be honest, I'm a fan of pretty much all of them, apart from the Madonna one's rubbish, and the Jack White, Alicia Keys one was pretty crap. But pretty much all the theme songs are pretty good. I even particularly like On Her Majesty's Secret Service, which is actually instrumental, so it's not really a song as such, but... that's just a really brilliant tune as well, so...
It is.
I agree with Andrew there, because, you know, I think I like Sheryl Crow on Tomorrow Never Dies, and also Garbage doing The World Is Not Enough. And, you know, these were, like, sort of minor, what you can think, minor bands or minor artists. But I think they were all pretty good, to be honest. There's not that many bad ones. I didn't like the Sam Smith one, I have to say.
Oh, no. No, I'd forgotten about that.
Adele was okay, but because she was getting towards a bit more, like, bassy almost, you know, but the Sam Smith one wasn't for me. But.
Yeah, no, tend to agree.
Oh, also, big shout out for another 80s child is Aha, The Living Daylights.
yeah.
A little bit more poppy. It's probably the poppiest
I was getting
ever.
Mixed up before. I think the Walkman scene is actually in The Living Daylights. I think the Walkman bit is in The Living Daylights, if I recall correctly. That's another brilliant one.
Apparently Aha didn't like the version of it that went in the film. They didn't really get on with John Barry or something. Cause
I see.
There's a version of The Living Daylights. It's just a track on one of their albums, and they prefer that version. It's not really got any of the orchestration on it, but for some reason they fell out with John Barry and they didn't really like the actual Bond theme version, so
I'll have to listen to that just to see what's different about it. I think there's a couple that stand out for me, as you say, Live and Let Die. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah,
and
brilliant.
When they use that again in the action scenes too, it gives the film an extra sort of momentum, and I love that as well. I remember reading about it, and like McCartney wrote it. Obviously, I think it was McCartney and Wings who did it in the film, but after he wrote it, and obviously we know how great it is, I think they wanted somebody else to sing it, and they were like trying to get him to let somebody else sing it, and he was like, no, this is mine, I'm going to be singing it, and thank God he did, because it's just brilliant. obviously, we've talked a lot about the things we love about Bond, and obviously there's so much we do love and so many films we do love, but are there any particular Bond films that you haven't liked or anything like that, or any particular scenes even that stand out that you think, you know, you really disliked? And I'll start with you on this one, Andrew.
Well, I should sort of preface this by saying I've only seen it once, but I was pretty disappointed with Spectre, to be honest, the most recent one.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's the worst one, because it isn't, but it's sort of the latest one. And yeah, I just found it quite sort of long and stodgy and not that many good scenes. Not entirely without good scenes, but then I think pretty much all the films have got some merit to them in some way or another. As much as I don't dislike the films, but as much as I like the Connery films, I think by the last couple, Thunderball and You Only Live Twice, he's kind of sleepwalking through it a little bit. And again, I think they could probably be better. And the last couple of Moore ones, I mean, View to a Kill, I do find entertaining, but it is just basically rubbish from start to finish.
So bad it's good.
Yeah, it probably is a bit of that. And like you were saying about sort of specific scenes, I mean, nothing hugely springs to mind, but to be honest, with the Bond films, I think pretty much all of them have got good bits and bad bits, and obviously the better ones have far more good bits, but a lot of them have got sort of cheesy scenes in, or like I said earlier, sort of gadgets that are a bit lame and stuff. So, but they're the ones that sort of spring to my mind. I don't know what Dan thinks.
Yeah, I think the one I was most disappointed with ever was Quantum of Solace, because it came after Casino Royale, which is absolutely belting. And the problem with Quantum of Solace is it was in the middle of the Hollywood writers' strike. And the filming of it was suspended for a while, like all American network TV shows were. And the problem was, instead of just coming back and waiting, and you know, they didn't want to stop production, they ended up, and the script went nowhere. It was all right, hodgepodge, botched job. You know, it was so disappointing.
It was boring, wasn't it?
Okay. Yeah, it was, and you know, you could just see the plot wasn't there. And I think maybe if they had the writers there, like, you know, you could say they maybe were the victim of the strike, maybe it might have been better, but. Yeah, that was really bad. But the other thing is a recurring theme is the final ones from the Bonds. I thought Diamonds Are Forever is really poor from Connery. The last two from Moore, Octopussy and View to a Kill, I don't like those films at all. I don't mind For Your Eyes Only, to be honest, but it's just the two after it, Die Another Day for it's really bad. You know, we mentioned the car. But then, you know, the way the surfing on
terrible
tidal wave, yeah, just awful. And I don't like The Living Dead. I don't like A License to Kill either, with Timothy Dalton's second one. So yeah, I think they've got. There's been a problem with knowing when to go out, going out at the top, and leaving the fans wanting more. You know, I guess the archetypal one of that is when George Lazenby came in. He bombed, really. He was hated, and he was terrible. He is easily the worst Bond ever. And then they had to get Connery back, and you know, when Connery was a bit, you know, when he could, yeah, and that was a really bad film, Diamonds Are Forever. So
yeah, some great shouts there. I agree with most of them. I do like License to Kill, but I know that sort of splits people. But some great shouts there for like some of the poorer Bonds. There's quite a few bad scenes, but one that always made me cringe, I'm not sure what Connery one it was, the one where there's two girls in the pool and he puts the head on them.
That's Diamonds Are Forever.
Oh, that
Bambi and Thumper.
Yeah, that's an awful moment. But and I think you mentioned before, I love aspects of this film, The Man with the Golden Gun, but it's got some really distasteful bits, and like, you know, I think Britt Eklund's character, another woman comes and he makes her go in the wardrobe and just
yeah. She goes in the boot of a car at one point.
You know, I don't know, there's bits of that. I think that could have been a great film, because and the karate bit, off to the karate bit, you know, with the dojo. It's like a different film in the middle of it for me. You know, I know some people probably like it, but it just felt like a different film shoehorned in again to appeal to, like, the you know, the martial arts market, whereas I think if they just concentrated on that dynamic of, you know, the world's best assassin versus the world's best spy, that's so rich to me, and the character clash between them could have been amazing. But I still enjoy the film, but there's just some bits that really, you know, I don't like at all.
One of the ones which is a little bit, these days, a little bit uncomfortable watching back at the time, is the Sheriff J.W. Pepper scenes from Live and Let Die, and it's the undercurrent of, I think it's Deep South racism and rednecks, isn't it, basically, and it is a little bit, I do find it a little bit uncomfortable watching those scenes back now.
Totally agree. I think it's one thing laughing at this redneck sheriff for being a fool, but at times it's sort of trying to get you to laugh at him being a racist, and it's just uncomfortable, isn't it, the way he's obviously, you know, treating some of the people in it, and just, I think he does it again in Golden Gun as well, doesn't he?
They bring it back for some reason, don't they?
Yeah, it's a really strange character to bring back, but I suppose that's another thing that would only happen in that sort of more era. But yeah, no, not a big fan of him either. Obviously, we've talked now about some of the bad ones. Is there any maybe underrated films that people you would recommend to anyone listening if they mightn't have seen it, or they maybe haven't gave it a chance, any of them that you'd recommend people to either visit for the first time or revisit them?
I would make a plea to you to go out and watch From Russia With Love, because I think it's a fantastic spy thriller in its own right. If you like that genre, you'll love it. But the other one I was going to call out was The Living Daylights, because it's not really on TV very often. No. And I think it is. It's a very good. It's quite stripped down. Not too many gadgets. It's set, you know, kind of Eastern Bloc again. There's a fantastic ski mountain sequence, then end up going down the mountain on a cello. Mm-hmm. You know, it's got a gorgeous girl, Marion Darbo. I think it's a really good one, and I do like Timothy Dalton in that one. I think he's pretty good. So that would be one I would say is quite underrated.
Yeah, no, I'd agree there. What about yourself, Andrew? Any for you? I know we've mentioned a lot.
Well, they'll probably wind you two up, but one of my first thoughts when I saw this question on the agenda was actually Quantum of Solace. I actually quite enjoy it. I don't know if you've watched it again lately. I'm not gonna make a claim for it to be one of the best or anything like that, but I watched it again quite recently, and there's a lot of good sequences. Now, it may not make much sense, and the plot's not that good. Oh, some guy wants to charge a bit more for water is basically the plot. But I just think there's a lot of good sequences in it. And unlike one like Spectre, which just goes on far too long, is nearly 2.5 hours, Quantum of Solace is like 100 minutes, and it's got quite good sequences in there. But obviously, I know you're not going to agree with me on that, and it's not to everyone's taste, but I think I didn't enjoy it at the time when I saw it, but going back, I think that there's sort of things in there to enjoy, even if it's still not a brilliant film.
Yeah, I think one of the things, the two characters, minor characters, which do make it a good film, I think it's Mathis.
Yeah, he's good.
He's brilliant in Casino Royale. He's a fantastic minor character on the good side. Always sort of he's a bit esoteric, actually, isn't he? You know, is he good? Is he, you know? Anyway, I also really like the Felix Leiter. The portrayal of Felix Leiter in those two, I don't know the actor's name, I'm afraid.
Jeffrey Wright.
That's probably the best portrayal of Felix Leiter I've seen as well. And there's that scene when he goes to, I think he breaks out of the embassy somewhere, and he meets him in his seedy bar somewhere, doesn't he?
Yeah,
in the KGB. That is actually a pretty good scene, I have to say.
Yeah, so I think there are some good bits in it. The other one I would, I think is possibly underrated is For Your Eyes Only. I think it's a really good one.
Great chance. Yeah.
Possibly more for me, as I'm sort of perhaps more of a fan of the earlier ones, but in the sort of crazy camp madness of the sort of Moore era, it's probably his most down-to-earth one, and I think it's better for it. I think it's probably like his closest one to like a Connery sort of 60s style Bond, and I really like it, and I think it's possibly underrated. So
I agree with that. It is, and it also the most downmarket Bond car ever, the Citroen 2CV.
Yeah,
going down a French hillside or so whatever, it's an Italian hillside in a 2CV. It's fantastic,
and a lovely Bond girl as well. So you can throw that in there as well. So
and I think, as you say, I think that's the most cold-blooded Moore's ever been in a film, as you say, the most like a Connery or maybe what Fleming envisaged that Moore ever got to anyway. And that takes us neatly on, I suppose, to obviously the Craig era was heavily influenced by, you know, the Bourne films and went darker and grittier. You know, you could, I suppose, say it's returning to its roots as well. Did you enjoy that direction that it took? Or I think, obviously, from what you've said, I get the impression you both did. If you could tell me what you thought of that, Dan.
Oh, hugely, hugely enjoyed it. I mean, I think after Die Another Day, which was about 2002, I think something like that, they had to do something because the Bourne film started before Casino Royale came back, didn't it?
Yeah.
Bourne was, what, about 2005, the first Bourne film, 2006?
I think it might even be a bit earlier than that, but it could be one.
Yeah, because Die Another Day was really poor.
Yeah.
And it was the peak, peak sort of over-the-top CGI and gadgetry and stuff like that. And then Bourne comes along, it is basically back to basics, stripped down, mano a mano, no gadgets. And I don't think they had any choice but to adapt. And to be honest, they were quite clever. You know, Bond has evolved. And for example, the first, you know, in GoldenEye, when M is a woman, obviously Judi Dench, and she's pretty good to have to say as M the whole way through. And then, you know, she calls him into the office, doesn't she? And she says, "Oh, you're like a relic of the Cold War. You're a dinosaur."
Yeah,
and you know, it moves on, and they try to. Brosnan does try to adapt to the late 90s time, and I think they had to do it again. And they got Craig in, and Craig got the role on the strength of Layer Cake, I think it was, when he played an East End gangster, I think, and it's a really good film. I like Layer Cake, and he got it ahead of people like Clive Owen, if I recall.
Yeah.
He wasn't particularly fancied by the British media at the time, mainly because he was blonde, I think. Yeah, he was short.
Really random, isn't it, though?
Yeah, because apparently Bond has to be dark, you know, and so anyway, because he's dark in the books, I guess. But yeah, I think the first time we see him, he does a Ursula Andress coming out of the sea, and he's there and he's absolutely ripped, isn't he? Basically, yeah. And he walks out of the sea, and then there's the scene in Miami Airport, which is just unbelievable. There's obviously the torture scene, which is incredibly powerful. That, you know, the scene that just because it's just so brutal, but so ingenious what they do. It's just so powerful. And then in the middle of it, you've got that the extended casino scene, which is absolutely fantastic with Le Chiffre. I mean, it's just, I think Casino Royale is better than any of the Bourne films. They saw what Bourne did, and then they raised it some after that. It's just a brilliant, brilliant film.
Personally, I'd take the Bourne films, but it is an excellent film. There's no doubt about that. I know it's just a matter of opinion, which would be your favourite, but or agree with all your points there, really. I've really enjoyed the direction, and I like as well that it gave us a Bond who was a relative novice and learning at times, and that was an interesting angle to take. So, no, I really like this different direction. What about yourself, Andrew? Were you a fan of it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly a fan of the films and sort of agree with everything Dan said. I mean, I do wonder if they possibly made, this is no criticism of Daniel Craig's portrayal, but whether they made Bond just a little bit too sort of vulnerable in the recent sort of Craig ones, which is not something you necessarily associate with him. But I guess that's just sort of personal taste on my part. But no, I mean, I think the films have generally been very good. And this darker thing is probably for the best. And as I said right at the beginning, I mean, that's how it's been. You know, the films have tended to evolve and go with the times. You know, the Bond films are very good at sort of tapping into what's current. And you could argue then that it perhaps makes them look dated sort of 20 or 30 years later. But, you know, they're very much sort of on point with the sort of current mood of cinema, I think. And I think they've done a really good job. But I mean, particularly after Die Another Day, I mean, it couldn't have got much worse, I guess. But they certainly pulled things around for the better, definitely.
Well, I'm just aware of the time, so I'm just going to ask you both very briefly. Obviously, Daniel Craig's tenure is coming to its end. If you could just say very quickly, who will be your shout for the next Bond? Firstly, Andrew.
Well, I'm not really doing anything, you know, if they need somebody, but
I like it.
Yeah. But
you've got my vote.
Yeah, I suppose a Stato's more of a Q figure than a Bond figure. But I don't know, you hear so much about Idris Elba, and I can't honestly see it happening, but I think it would be really interesting if he got it. I think, yeah. I mean, realistically, he's probably a bit old, because whoever gets it will presumably do 3 or 4 films, so it's sort of like committing for a decade or so. But it's something I'd like to see, albeit I don't think it would really happen. The other one that gets talked about a lot is Tom Hiddleston, but there's just something about him doesn't sit right with me for Bond. I don't know what it is.
I don't think he's got that. He doesn't have that. Obviously, I know some of them haven't, but we've all seemed to like that sort of a Bond that looks like he could physically kill someone if needed, and I don't think he has that. I know people can bulk up, but he wouldn't be believable to me as a spy at that level.
No, he's a bit slight, I think, possibly to be Bond. I mean, a good actor. I'm sure he could probably do a pretty good job. But I'm not sure. I'd quite buy it. Beyond those two, I haven't really got any suggestions. I don't know who else. It's a tough job. I don't know who could do it, really.
And yourself, Dan. Obviously, we can't vote for Andrew now. He's already. Other than Andrew, who would you go for, mate?
I think they're two of the best candidates, to be honest. I mean, I would absolutely love Idris Elba to get it.
Because
I don't think he looks his age.
No, he doesn't.
True.
And he's enormous, isn't he? He's a huge man. I mean, he's so brutal in Luther. He's one of the best. Luther's one of the best detective characters I've ever seen.
Definitely.
And he's brutal, and he's so physical.
And he's so charismatic as well, isn't he?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. God, he just oozes charisma. Yeah, absolutely. So he would be a really, really, really fascinating choice. One I always wanted to get it. In about 2000 was Ralph Fiennes. I did want him. In a bit. Obviously, it's funny now because he's now in the films as M. But I would love. I would really loved him to get a couple because again, he's a big man. You know, he's a big man, and he I think he could have done the physical stuff.
Well, I think he's showing now, isn't he, that he could have done it? You know, because he's still great in these ones as a sort of. I think he's XSAS or something. So I think you're right. He'd have been great.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, he's obviously too old now and stuff like that, but back in the day, I think I would have really liked him. I really like Tom Hiddleston, I have to say. I do like him a lot. But again, I think he would be more Pierce Brosnan than Daniel Craig.
Yeah.
But I do like him. He's certainly charming enough. He's certainly handsome enough.
Yeah.
And he's certainly, I mean, I really liked him as Loki, to be honest. in Thor and the Avengers film. So, yeah, he's got to be a real candidate because, and again, he's they're both British. I mean, him and Idris Elba are both British, aren't they?
The couple of great shouts. The one I'd like to get probably either Idris Elba or this guy. I don't know whether he might be getting a bit too old. I'm not sure exactly how old he is. Michael Fassbender, I think.
Yes.
In Inglourious Bastards, where he was playing the German soldier, I think he had a really great balance of toughness and charm, and I think he would be great. And he's another Liverpool fan, which helps. So after Craig, but no, any of the names mentioned, even although I think maybe. Hiddleston might be a little too slight. He's a brilliant actor and so charismatic. I think any of those will be perfect. So it'll be interesting.
Hiddleston's got the age on his side because he's only 35 now.
Good point.
So Fassbender's 39 and Idris Elba's 43. I just looked it up now.
I see.
It wouldn't surprise me if they went for a light-hearted one. Because when you think about it, they do tend to sort of swing back and forth, sort of Connery to Moore and then Moore to Dalton.
True.
To Brosnan, a bit more light-hearted, then back to Craig. So it wouldn't surprise me if they went for a light-hearted one to kind of go back the other way. So,
and maybe just keep it on a 2-3 film deal, and and then change around to next. You know, make sure people don't stay in the role too long, and they don't get most importantly, they don't get too old in the role as well.
I reckon you could pull off light-hearted Andrew. So I think you've got a chance. You've got a chance, mate. No, brilliant talking to you both there. It'll be interesting to see what direction Bond takes next. And I'd just like to thank you both for coming on, and thank everyone for listening. And obviously, you know, if you're a Liverpool fan, you'll know you two, you're great followers. Where can people find more of your work, firstly, Andrew?
Well, I guess Twitter is the main place, to be honest. I do have a blog, basetunetored.com, as well, but I'm too busy to actually write anything on it these days. So Twitter's probably the best place, I think.
And your handle on there?
It's at basetunetored, which doesn't mean a lot to many people, but sort of a play on a Super Furry Animals song. But yeah, basetunetored. Normally tweeting stats out about Liverpool, but Bond stuff more and more at the moment as well. So might see me doing that as well.
A must follow. Same with Dan. And where can people find more of your work and your thoughts, Dan?
Well, I don't blog anywhere near as much as I do, but if I do blog, it's most likely to be for Tonkin's Times. But I'm at Dan Kennett on Twitter, 2 N's, 2 T's. And I should have mentioned Tom Hardy, by the way.
Oh yeah, he'd be great as well. Another great chap.
He's got to be a genuine candidate, I think.
Yeah, no, there's a great selection.
Especially after
there.
The craze.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think he's got the lot. He really could be. He's another great one, and obviously he's clearly after seeing Bane and things like that, and Bronson, and obviously the craze, as you say, you know, you believe he could break someone's neck if it came down to that. So no, I think he's
another great. Got a psycho side. Definitely.
So another great shout there. Another must follow in Dan. If you like LFC and in particular stats and analytics, these guys, obviously I'm sure you'll already know, but they are great followers for so much information. Thanks to everybody for listening. Obviously thanks to the guests for coming on. Always welcome feedback, good or bad, film suggestions, anything like that. Please on Twitter at Joe Simpson, at JoeSimpson79, or at AI Movie Night at AI Movie Night. Thanks for listening.
Do you expect me to talk?
No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.